and happy Valentine's Day to everyone. And I guess you didn't get the memo that you're supposed to bring the committee chocolate on Valentine's Day, because we don't see it up here. I have to send you guys back.
As long as it doesn't cost over $10.
Right. Exactly. That was just a joke. So, okay, we are actually going to reverse the schedule that has been posted for the agenda, and we're going to hear House Bill 2565 first. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2565 relating to minimum energy efficiency standards. And colleagues, this is a bill that I worked on last session, and we actually have a technical fix for this. Kat's going to give a little bit of a description, and then the Department of Energy is going to come up and give an explanation of what's in front of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I don't have any detail that I was going to go into. This is just a bill that is, as the Chair explained, updating a bill that passed last session, creating minimum energy efficiency standards for certain appliances. That bill at that time matched the California standards. California subsequently changed their standards, and this bill is attempting to bring operative dates and certain of the standards back into line with the California standards.
Okay, thank you, Kat. Appreciate it. And I think we are going to have a couple of folks from the Department of Energy come up, and then we'll take public testimony on that. So Bill Nesmith and John Kaufman. And they will explain in a little more detail for the committee why this bill is before you. And this is a committee bill, by the way, so this was one of the ones that we had introduced at the beginning of the session. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Appreciate it. And whoever wants to go first, just make sure and state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Nesmith, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2565. Sitting next to me is the agency's appliance expert, John Kaufman. House Bill 2565 corrects unforeseen problems that occurred as a result of passage last session of House Bill 3363. Specifically, it corrects energy efficiency standards and operative dates for two categories of equipment authorized under House Bill 3363 to be consistent with California's standards. And it grants limited rulemaking authority to the Oregon Department of Energy to allow us to adopt rules relating to efficiency standards, labeling effective dates, and related matters. About a dozen states have adopted appliance standards similar to the standards included in House Bill 3363, and these include Washington and California. Our intent was to be consistent with these other states. Unfortunately, California adopted standards and effective dates for a couple of affected appliances, which put Oregon in the awkward position of being inconsistent with these standards. Several manufacturers contacted us and warned us that we needed to update our statutes or be faced with the possibility of not having product available here in Oregon. We've worked with the industry to bring you a simple bill that addresses the issue. John and I are happy to address any questions you might have about the bill.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions for the Department of Energy on this? And colleagues, I will tell you that I worked with several of the manufacturers approached me during the interim, and then we set up a meeting with the Department of Energy, and we felt that this was the best solution. And so you will hear from many of the folks representing manufacturers. We have Consumer Electronics Association. Several folks are going to come up and talk about this. But if there's any specific questions about technicalities, and as you can imagine, we could not write the bill to say we will have the same date as California. Legally, we couldn't do that. And so, unfortunately, since in Oregon we only meet every other year, in that off year, that's when the California had changed their implementation date. And obviously, we were not in session, so we could not come back and do it. And since it was in statute, we couldn't do it through rule. And the manufacturers didn't feel comfortable doing it through rule. They requested doing it through statute. So thus, the bill before you. Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought we were just going to legislatively tell California they couldn't do it without checking with us first.
I tried that, but... a governor.
I'd like to explore a little bit further, and I know we've got subsequent witnesses, so this is kind of a standing question for everybody. I'd like to have this. The last page of this bill adds quite a bit of language regarding giving the department further authority to do this stuff. And I guess what I'm really interested in is, you know, how much of a hardship is this? I mean, how urgent is it that we have to change these things, that we give the department that much authority to do this, and then come back to us and ask for the legislative blessing on it after the fact? I mean, why aren't we just striking all this out and say, just like we are right now, where we've got this additional criteria for the AC/DC devices, come to the legislature and get this updated.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I'm going to let Mr. Kaufman answer that. He's done a lot of research on this. I believe that the rulemaking, you know, is in the best interest of all concerned, but John's done the research and talked with the California people in the other states. I think he can give you a good answer on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I'm John Kaufman. I'm policy analyst with the Department of Energy. I have responsibility for implementing this bill with the department. In answer to your question, the reason we have some of the other language in here is, you know, we need the rulemaking authority to prevent the situation where we have to come in to fix a bill like this. We have the window in the interim is the problem. There's a window where the bill is in effect where they have to comply, but they can't comply. What they will wind up doing is winding up not sending product into Oregon as a result, and the products will not be available in Oregon because they don't meet the standard. That's exactly what happened with California. The reason California changed was the manufacturers were unable to meet the standard as of the effective date, just, you know, retooling, gearing up their product to manufacture it. They weren't able to get it on the market at a particular date, and yet we had that date in statute. So if they can't meet Oregon standard, they just won't ship the product. It won't be available in Oregon. That's why we want the rulemaking authority in the interim to change it, then to come back and obviously get approval, but in the meantime, so we can get some kind of product in Oregon.
That answer your question?
Well, I'm not sure that it does, Madam Chair, but I think it's probably more just because of my lack of good, thorough understanding of how this whole process works. I mean, I can appreciate from a manufacturer's perspective, they don't want to be making two different products, one for California and one for Oregon. And certainly that's not in our best interest either. But I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding how this stuff happens. So, you know, is it that urgent? Help me understand the urgency of this.
And, you know, we will have the manufacturers come up and talk about that, and okay. I think they can probably address the question, so if you can hold
sure,
that.
Sure.
And then, by the way, if anybody has a cell phone or a BlackBerry on, can you please make sure and turn it off, because that it affects our audio system. So did you have a question, Representative Cannon, or anyone?
No.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen, if you will stick around, because I'm sure there'll be other questions. I think as we have more witnesses come up who can explain this, because there are many folks in the room who are working with us on this bill last session. So I'm going to call up Sean Miller. And let's see. Yeah, and Bruce Bishop. Is Bruce here?
No?
Okay. Let's stand in for Bruce. Great. Thank you, Sean. You'll pass around your light bulb, okay. Great. Thank you. And for the record.
Yeah, for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller, and I represent the National Electrical Manufacturers Association, NEMA, and their lighting division, which includes member companies such as Philips, General Electric, and Sylvania, companies who manufacture much of the nation's light bulbs. House Bill 2565, as stated by the Chair, is a technical fix from House Bill 3363, which passed last session, and we're here in full support of it. I think you've heard a good background on why consistency among the western states, California, Oregon, and Washington, is important, but I'll just dive right into Representative Burley's question of why this is so important to manufacturers and having a consistent process. When we passed 3363 at the end of legislative session last in 2 years ago, California was still in the process of their rulemaking, and they do it different. California, it's all by rule. In Oregon, they chose to take these energy efficiency statutes and put them into statute. The problem is, from a manufacturer standpoint, when you're actually trying to decide what scientifically is energy efficient and what is not, when things change, manufacturers such as GE, Philips, and Sylvania want consistency to be able to, through their wholesale, and be able to distribute those products to every Home Depot. You name it. On the lighting side, for instance, I'll just direct your attention to page, just use an example. Page 11 of the bill actually shows on incandescent reflector lamps, which is one of the items that was not consistent in California. After our legislative session, they were evaluating what incandescent reflector lamp should be exempt from the energy efficiency statute. And you see a list of very specific lamps. And most of them are a wattage requirement. And the example that I have passed around is just a 65-watt BR40, which is in line 4 of the bill. That is a common light bulb. It's in my home. It's the recess lighting that is in most homes. I think the home builders will say that they like to build homes like that. Actually, when we passed our law, the process of evaluating what was energy efficient wasn't done, and we said that all reflector lamps are under this statute, which that light, when this were to go into effect, I would not be able to buy that light in the state of Oregon. And that light, again, it's a wattage requirement, and you can see that it's exempt in the bill. California passed it. Washington quickly passed it, and unfortunately for us, the manufacturers, Washington had an annual session. And so they were able to come in at their 60-day session last year, quickly pass it. This particular part of the statute went into effect in 07. And we were fortunate enough through rulemaking to be able to delay the implementation of this because rulemaking and enforcement wasn't done. It is very critical for the manufacturers to let their retailers know. And they were getting calls from every Home Depot, every Fred Meyer. You can buy this light just about anywhere because it's probably in all your homes. Very worried. You tell us what we need to do because if we got to pull this off our shelf. So we immediately met with the Department of Energy. The letter that you have behind the my testimony is a letter that, fortunately, knowing that these were still in discussions, I want to thank the chair, Dingfelder, who was the sponsor of 3363. She actually read that letter on the House floor, knowing that this was going to be an issue, and acknowledged that on the House floor, and therefore we are back to try to fix it. To make, again, California, Washington, Oregon have the same distribution network, and so we're all playing under the same rules. So I just wanted to use that as an example and how critical it is to make the adjustment. Oregon, obviously, every 2 years we come into session. If things change, it's going to put a kink in the distribution network from the manufacturer side. So if that answers your question on that,
that helps a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, and I'm representing the Consumer Electronics Association. Our members manufacture the external power supplies, which are the power strips that, I mean, Sean talks about light bulbs in your home. We have power strips in your home, okay? And we had the same problems with not being concerned about not being able to distribute our product to Oregon because of inconsistent standards between Oregon, Washington, and California. So we have appreciated the opportunity to work with the department and the chair on this legislative fix and anticipate that that'll take care of our whole West Coast distribution problem.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
I got to get that back in my kitchen.
Yes, we can't accept this anyway. So there you go. Thank you. Committee members, I just wanted to note that there was a bit of discussion, and we have Mike Rainey from the Department of Energy here, about this is the classic example of when you put things in statutes versus through rule. And we had a lot of discussions about that last session, and the manufacturers and folks felt more comfortable being in statute. This is the trade-off of things being statute versus having in rule where there's more flexibility. So I am sorry that we have this bill in front of you, but it is an important bill because the legislation that passed last session passed overwhelmingly in both the House and Senate. There's a Senate bill that is an expansion of this program that will be coming through this committee, hopefully, here in the next few weeks, that looks at some additional products. So we will be hearing more about this. But it saves, we figured out at the time, $230 million in energy savings. And as we're looking at new ways to stretch energy supplies, that was a very important piece of legislation that we did get passed. So we want to make sure that it's implemented correctly. So I'm done editorializing, and I will call up the rest of the witnesses. Tom O'Connor from Oregon Municipal Utilities. I hope I didn't steal your thunder in saying talking about energy efficiency. And why don't we ask Liz Frankel? I didn't see Liz, but she signed up with the Oregon League of Women Voters. Okay, Liz isn't here. Jeff Bissonnette, you want to come up, Jeff? And Jeremiah from Usberg. If you don't mind sharing the witness stand. Thanks for coming, Tom.
Madam Chair, Tom O'Connor, for the record, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, and you covered it, I guess, from a utility perspective. The efficient appliances built in from the get-go are much more cost-effective than having to go back in 3 or 4 years later when we're concerned about carbon impacts and energy savings. So we supported the original bill. We support this fix. It makes sense to have that flexibility.
Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm here for the Citizens Utility Board and the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. We sort of helped the chair shepherd this last time through the process, and I just wanted to sort of come and say it was always the intention to make sure that there was sort of consistency throughout the West Coast, and after the session kind of had some of these issues come up, and so we wanted to make sure that folks knew that we were in support of the changes and look forward to having the expanded discussion that the chair referred to with a Senate bill coming through later. And so we'll have more detail on that, but this is a good bill, should pass. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for your time. Jeremiah Bauman, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'll keep it incredibly brief to avoid redundancy. Usberg also supported this bill last session and supports making changes to keep this consistent across states. I'll also second the chair's comments that there is a further expansion of energy efficiency standards for other appliances, including, in particular, home furnaces, which are the bulk of most families' energy bills and which will save Oregonians a lot of money. I think that might be a good opportunity to talk about this rulemaking question again, because I think you can sort of go both ways on it. The key flexibility for manufacturers is allowing the department to update with technical changes, or even in some situations, as there are new standards that make sense. And certainly, I think a look through the bill makes it clear that I think that these are incredibly technical. You know, we're talking about 115 kilovolts, 50 watts. These are decisions probably we could use a little more input and advice from the best experts in our state who are at the department. And so it might make sense to look to some of those states who have decided that the department can, through an appropriate public process with public input and hearings, propose increased energy efficiency standards. But that's probably not a subject to get into for this particular bill. We could do that with other bill that's changing standards across the board.
Okay. Are there any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And does anyone see Liz Frankel if she's outside? Okay. I'm going to close the public here. Let's see if we can find Liz, because she did sign up. So okay, no? Okay, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2565, and I'm now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2187. This is on fees for periodic sanitary surveys of drinking water systems. And
thank you.
Kat, if you want to give a brief description. Okay. Well, we're switching teams here. Beth Petrino, who we are fortunate enough to have helping us staff this committee on loan from agricultural, from the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, is our water guru for the committee, and she's going to actually work on the next few bills.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2187 authorizes the Department of Human Services to impose a fee on water suppliers for the cost of conducting sanitary services. And the purpose of the fee is to recover the cost of the survey.
Okay, thank you. And first, we are going to have Gail Shibley from the Department of Human Services come up and give a little more background overview of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I am the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health and Public Health Division of Oregon's Department of Human Services. I am delighted to be here with you today. I'm only going to take maybe 60 seconds of time because we've got about seven other folks who have participated so much in this task force and who want to voice their support for this measure. We are here today to ask your consideration and support for a bill that then-Chair Jensen championed and helped ensure the successful passage out of the House Water Committee in the 05 session. As you may recall from my presentation, an overview of drinking water in the state of Oregon, we unfortunately just flat out are not getting the job done that is required under federal law, under federal regulations, under our contract with the U.S. EPA, nor are we providing any of the services that are required under ORS 448 for the quote-unquote very small systems of 4 to 14 connections. We know that. We've been asking for additional funding for some time. We've been improving our technology, providing cross-training, otherwise trying to squeeze every bit of efficiency and productivity out of tremendously talented and dedicated folks at the county and state levels. We, however, in Oregon are not even maximizing the number of federal dollars that we have available to us because we cannot provide sufficient state match. Mm-hmm. And so we are leaving about $250,000 federal dollars on the table, and we want, frankly, to stop that. And that's going to take about the same amount in state dollars. As a result of a task force that looked at the needs, priorities, and resource gaps for state drinking water, they identified that, you know, we've got kind of a three-part problem, and this bill addresses one of those three parts. It does not address the entire issue, but it does take on maximizing the state dollars, the federal dollars, and we do that by establishing the authority to have a discussion to institute a fee for sanitary surveys. Be happy to answer any questions, but I'd like to just kind of hang out here and ask the members of the task force. I do want to give a particular thanks to tremendous volunteers who have worked on this from all over the state, from Dan Bradley, Chuck Carpenter, Dave Kreider, Jason Green, Todd Heidrichton, Roger Jordan, Mike Mazaros from Curry County, Tom Penpraise from Corvallis, Luis Quistad, Amanda Rich, Richard Soa, and Willie Tiffany. Many of them are here today and want to make sure that you understand that although it means opening up their wallets, they support this bill. And so I ask your consideration and your support.
Thank you, Gail. And I would like to bring up some members of the task force, and then if you can stick around for questions, I appreciate it. But so I wanted to invite Todd and Amanda up first. And Representative Jensen, would you like to add anything? Because you worked very hard in this last session.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would, but let's hear from the people on the ground here who have real involvement with this, if that's all right with you, Madam Chair.
That sounds great. And Willie has joined us as well. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Todd Heigerkin, and I'm here on behalf of
of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and also I had an opportunity to serve as a member of the Task Force on Drinking Water Program Workload and Funding that worked on these recommendations. And really, House Bill 2187 stems from some recommendations that were included in that task force report that is kind of the final piece of the puzzle from in implementing that report. This is the report here. Thank you. Visual aids are good. The state uses the sanitary surveys not only to comply with the requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act, but it also assures citizens that as water providers we have the plans, the policies, and infrastructure necessary to make sure we're providing water in a safe and healthful manner. As such, this is kind of a third party, the sanitary survey service, kind of a third party review of our systems, and it's something that all water providers are required to do as part of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, as I said. Charging a fee for these sanitary surveys will provide DHS with the necessary revenue to comply with the federal mandate that they have to, and enable them to continue on the schedule that they're required to as well. What House Bill 2187 simply does is to give DHS the authority or the ability to charge a fee for these sanitary surveys. We look forward to working with the department as those fees are developed for the different water providers, but feel it's critical part of that. By the way, I do work for a water provider that will be subject to this fee and will have to pay it. So, with that, I just want to thank you for your attention to this legislation and for implementing kind of the final piece of that task force report, and would urge your support for House Bill 2187.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I wear a couple of hats here today. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and you've just heard their position on this bill from Todd. I also represent the Oregon Association of Water Utilities, and usually folks don't get up and testify when they're neutral on a bill, but I want to mention that because traditionally the Oregon Association of Water Utilities is extremely opposed to fee increases and usually sends me out charging against them. But in this case, they said, no, it's really, really important that the state maintain primacy over this program. And so even though our members are, Oregon Association of Water Utility members are generally opposed to fee increases, they're staying out of this and happy to let it go forward. So I know that's not a ringing endorsement, but it does mean something from them, really, for them not to be here opposing it. So wanted to place that on the record and, again, emphasize Special District Association support of the bill.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, we have very sensitive mics in here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and I also agree with the sentiments here from Ms. Rich, and I have some written testimony on some of the background. I just want to point out that prior to, well, and including the 2003 session, we had been at odds with the department over proposals to have direct collection fees on municipal water collections. There are a number of issues that we had problems with, and I think the leadership of Representative Jensen at that time to force our entities as well as all other groups to work with the department on an alternative that will fully fund the department to meet its obligations under the Safe Drinking Water Act. That should be noted. And this bill does that. We were looking at task force, which I also served on. The principles there were basically fee for service, look at the program, and what items does the program provide where fee for service makes sense, and where can we find full cost recovery for the programs that benefit the users. And I think we were able to do that. And as Todd indicated, this is the last but the biggest piece of the puzzle to get the department to that whole funding. I'm sure Ms. Shibley noted that there's a 2-to-1 federal match also on the table. That was also important for the task force to look for ways to leverage funds to get the department wholly funded at a level that meets the needs of the public and drinking water providers. So we're happy to support this legislation. We were happy to support this identical bill last session, and we're hopeful to see it passed this session. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
I do have a clarification, because in your testimony, Gail, it says 1-to-1 federal match, and I just heard Willie say 2-to-1. So
I defer to the department.
Madam Chair, I appreciate you flagging that very astute critical listener, because I did want to clarify that it is a one-to-one match now. It used to be a two-to-one match, but we've been able to increase a little bit more, and so now the feds make it a little tighter of a match, but it's still doubling your money as opposed to tripling. But
teaches me not to stay out of the room. One
Well, that's okay. I just was curious about that we weren't passing up some money there or something. So, okay, any questions for the panel? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amanda and Willie, both of you mentioned the primacy question, and I guess I want to make sure I understand. Is this primacy in the context of this is a delegated EPA matter, and that if we're not doing it correctly, EPA takes it back? Okay, well, that's very important.
Follow up.
Gail, you might want to step up if you would, please. And this is what we discussed on the way down here. I just want to get this on the record. I do have, Madam Chair, I did get a letter from the Crooked River Ranch Water Cooperative in which they raised some concerns, and I just wanted Gail to address these on the record, please. The first one, generally, what this gentleman is suggesting is that the only ones that should be paying are those that have unsanitary conditions. That's point one. Point two is that as a cooperative, nonprofit, they are trying to maintain their rates at a very reasonable level. And then point three, he says, please revise this bill to state that the charges would be based on cost alone. So, Gail, could you touch on those three points, please?
I'd be really pleased to, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, Vice Chair Burley, excuse me. Number one, while I appreciate people, organizations that may say, well, if you come out and do this service that is required under federal law and analyze the results and provide the report and there's nothing wrong, then I don't want to pay. There's a problem with that, both from a practical standpoint and then also from a sustainability of effort standpoint. If we have no idea what we're going to find, and we simply need to put kind of eyes on the plant and boots on the ground, so to speak, everybody has to pay something into that. Your second question.
His concern about trying as a cooperative nonprofit keeping the rates reasonable.
Yes, I appreciate that. And clearly, having not run a water utility in my lifetime yet, I'm not the best to speak to that from a personal standpoint. But I will tell you that, of course, cities are nonprofits, and sometimes really nonprofit special districts likewise. So we're not talking about private for-profit entities. In no matter their stripe, the Forest Service, State Department of Lands, state parks, anybody, nobody is in this to make money. And so consequently, as I said at the very beginning, we at the state level, we know that it's our responsibility to try to provide this oversight in the most efficient, cost-effective, common-sense, public health-focused way that we possibly can. And we've made tremendous strides in that area. We would like the opportunity with this authorization to, as Todd said, to have this discussion over the next year with all of the statewide stakeholders, not just the terrific 12 who got to serve on the task force, but with everybody so that we can set rates that make sense for the type of system, for the size of system, for the source of water, et cetera, et cetera. It's not an easy, you know, one size fits all, and it requires that kind of in-depth discussion that we want to engage in. We can't even have that discussion now without this authority.
Madam Chair, if I could add just a couple of points to that. During the task force process, we felt it was important to focus on items where the applicant receives a product, and that's what we're talking about here, is a state assessment of how your system is performing and then recommendations. But moreover, To the other point, you know, a number of my members and a number of Amanda's, who are the largest members, will clearly be subsidizing this program, and they do have many quality control measures in place that far surpass what a sanitary survey is. However, as representative cities and as representative districts, we represent the citizens of those cities, and I think those all of those entities felt it real important, whether it's the city of Bend or your family's on vacation in a smaller place or in a campground, that we need to be assured that the drinking water standards are being protected across the state for all entities, not just for those with the ability to pay.
Did you follow up?
We may be headed the same point here. I just wanted to ask. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the fiscal analysis paper, which I don't know if you have a copy of that or not, but there is a table of fees here. Is this what's being proposed? Or I see this as a tentative schedule. So I think what's important about this is it does answer the one question about, you know, the rates are based on capacity, which I think would help the co-op's concern about a disproportionate fee.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Burley, I believe, having just gotten this before the committee, I believe that fits with what we had talked about on the task force and published in our quarterly newsletter that goes out to all of the water utilities statewide. This is, as this table says in this article, recommended fees. This is, I think, the same or maybe actually I think we give a bigger subsidy to the 15 to 300 connections. So without knowing, in your example, Crooked River Ranch, you know, co-op, how many connections they have, my hunch is that either they pay zero or they would pay, I think, $150. And that's every 5 years. So we're talking about a de minimis amount of money. I appreciate the fact that it is real money. Don't get me wrong. It's a, you know, it's the nasty F word of fees. But it is pretty small considering what's at stake and the need for the dollars.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I need to understand the fee schedule. Is this an annual fee or is it a fee for service? Walk me through this.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I appreciate the question. We are required under Federal Safe Drinking Water Act to provide on-site surveys to every water utility in the state that is subject to federal regulation.
Gail, can you say how many that is in the state of Oregon?
In Oregon, that is around 2,700 subject to federal regulation. We've got about another 1,000 that are subject to state oversight under ORS 448 that, frankly, we're not doing anything for right now. But those subject to federal regulation are systems with 15 or more connections. And we are required to inspect those in person every 5 years if they have groundwater source and every 3 years if they have a surface water source. Okay. The overwhelming majority of drinking water systems in the state, in the EPA systems, quote unquote, have groundwater sources. So this is every 5 years. We now are something like 6 years frequency average instead of 3 to 5. So we are trying to get down to that required minimal health level. Each individual system is going to be different. If you ask, for example, Jack Sicking is here, who is a mobile homeowner, who is a manufactured home park owner, and I don't know when his last inspection was. It may have been yesterday, or it may have been 13 years ago.
So then, if I follow up, so the fee then is charged based upon when the periodic sanitary survey is conducted.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's exactly right.
Got it. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon?
Did you say, so thank you, Madam Chair, that there are 2,700 systems subject to the inspection?
Safe Drinking Water Act, under the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cannon, that's exactly right. They are what we call EPA systems, which means simply that they are subject to federal EPA regulations.
Well, I'm just curious, I'm trying to understand the same chart on the fiscal analysis here that shows 205 total inspections in, I believe, the 07-09 biennium. Even if you multiply that by five, or I guess it would be by 2.5 to account for the next 2 years, you don't get anywhere close to 2,700. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm actually going to use what I might refer to as kind of my drinking water Bible here.
Representative Jensen?
Madam Chair, we got a copy of that Bible 2 years ago.
I still have mine, I'm sure.
I can't speak to this. I'm sure that we can reconcile any differences in the numbers. But what we had done was take a look at the number with any surface water supplies, because those are on a 3-year frequency, the number with only groundwater supplies that are on a 5-year frequency, and then by size and by type. These, as you see, are the number of community water supplier connections, right? There are also, of course, non-transient, non-community water systems, transient, non-community water systems, of course, the non-EPA, very small water systems. And so just looking at the community water systems, I'd have to do some math here real quickly, which I'm not going to try, but the surface water adds up to about 348. The groundwater adds up to 3,213. That includes the very small systems as well as the federal EPA system. So I don't want to further confuse you, but it's a little apples and pineapples here, and so I'm happy to kind of comb through the numbers. But they really are consistent when you compare the same thing to the same thing.
I think what we'll have to do, committee members, is have LFO come up. I mean, we just were handed this. I don't think you've had a chance to even look at this yet. So we need to ask LFO what assumptions went into figuring out these numbers. I'm assuming that's how they come up with the two FTEs. They looked at how much it's going to take you over that 5-year period. But we may want to have somebody from LFO here if we have additional questions, because I had the same question that Representative Cannon did. So what I'd like to do is have Jack Sicking come up. Gail, maybe you can stay up here because there might be additional questions. Thank you, Amanda and Willie. I want to make sure we hear Jack, and then, yeah. And that's all that we have signed up for testimony. If you can, otherwise we'll have him come back.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and Jack is a board member and a small system owner. It was, I had a revolt amongst a few of my members when the fees were presented, and another of them, Wayne Hildebrand, and I met with Gil and managed to negotiate a lower fee that is in there now, and at this point we support it. And Jack, I would like to introduce himself and talk a little about his park.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for being here. And for the record, can you please state your name?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to be here. I was here 2 years ago also, and we had a good time then. To answer the question about whether I've ever been... You gotta talk to this thing. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jack Sicking. It's actually John Herman Sicking, but they called me Jack because I have a cousin that lived alongside of me, and his name was John, and it didn't work. So, there you go. I do have some experience in water. I was the chairman of a unit back in New Jersey. I was in elected politics also. And I ran the water and sewer department for a town of 25,000 people for 7 years. So I do know something about the water. Now I've been in Oregon for 10 years, and I've been associated with two mobile home parks that do have wells. We serve water, and they're both unchlorinated, and we have wonderful water. We have never had any sicknesses or problems or anything of that nature with them. And we don't have really a problem with being inspected. Matter of fact, since I was here last time, I've been inspected twice. That's in addition to the one time that I was inspected 2 years before I came here. So I've been inspected and found acceptable, I hope. my problem is cost. It's always cost. The park that I live in is an older park. It could be called a trailer park if you wanted to insult my people and insult me. But the truth of the matter is the people that live there are just making it. You know, they're able to make it. So if you start to put on more cost, as there are costs that are coming on, and even though it seems like a small amount, if you took $150 or whatever they're talking about over 5 years or whatever year that it comes in, I only have 42 spaces in the park that I'm in. So that has to be delivered out to the people. Now, to give you an example, my rents last year were $355. I raised my rent by $5. That's about a 1.1% increase. So if you give me more regulatory fees that I have to pay, I have to increase the rent more. Now, my aim is always to raise my rents less than what Social Security goes up so that the people can get ahead. And we did it, you know, because Social Security is up to 3.4% or something like that this year. The problem is, though, that my people are in a whiplash with this El Nino cold that's come to Oregon. Usually we have a nice warm winter with a lot of rain. This year we've had very cold winters, and I've had people that have come to me with $340 a month electric bills to heat their houses. Now, they're at a breaking point, and more cost coming in is just not helpful. Whenever I see it, I come out to a place like this, and I preach, and I try to keep the cost down. And that's where I stand. If there's a, I know they're talking about, is it $150
for more than 300?
For more than 200. For less than 200, 300. Zero. Oh, 300. 300 for what? For my people?
Mm-hmm.
For my people? 300 for
No. For less than 300, it's zero. Oh, my understanding
less
is
than
it's zero.
Zero.
For less than 300.
I'm in favor of this particular.
Let me make sure we're communicating straight here. Yeah, okay. Anything else that you would like to add?
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to come up here and talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today. Any questions?
Madam Chair, just a comment.
Representative Smith.
I would share with you that the gentleman's comments are not unique in that in past business opportunities, I've actually have overseen a park. And let me tell you, the clientele, those on fixed income, a dollar increase is significant. Mm-hmm. And so I want to say thank you for all you're doing for the folks who reside in your park, because I'll tell you what, I hope they ought to appreciate it. I hope they do, because that's a very humanitarian action.
We had we had a picnic at the summertime for the park, and one of the guys showed up with a shirt that said, "You mess with me, you mess with my whole park." My whole trailer park.
Thank you so
Peace.
Much.
Take care.
And committee members, we've asked legislative revenue to legislative fiscal to come up and maybe walk us through this chart, because this is the first time that we've seen this. This is on page 2 of your legislative fiscal status report. And maybe, John, if you could walk us through it, we'd appreciate it. And for the record, can you state your name?
Madam Chair, yes. If I might just interject, Liz Frankel was not able to get back from another meeting. She gave me her testimony, and that's what has been just handed out to you in support of this bill as well.
Thank you. And we'll note that for the record.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Borden with Legislative Fiscal. The chart you're referring to, or the table you're referring to on page of this measure's fiscal impact, was information provided to the Legislative Fiscal Office today, and it's in draft form from the agency because the measure does not specify the actual amount of the fees or the number of inspections. So they would set those administratively during the 07-09 biennium and establish their fees along with that process. And so this was the draft information they provided on the number of inspections and the associated fee and revenue that they would collect.
Okay. All right. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the assumptions that were made behind this? And if you can, or Gail, if you can just explain the chart since you now have it in front of you. I know you've been working off of yours. But, and just to make clear, this is what you're, this is a tentative schedule, what you're proposing, and then you're going to do a rulemaking. You're going to go through a public process and get feedback from this proposed schedule. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. This is meant to be a good, solid draft to provide people, regardless of the type of size of system, a very clear and thoughtfully produced recommendation. It's not at all a fait accompli. I'm not going to prejudge what's going to happen as a result of a series of hearings and discussions and comments and analysis and so on. But this is a slight amendment, as Mr. Brenneman said, from the recommendation that was poured over as a result of this task force. So, and if I may, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask probably the individual who knows more about drinking water in the state of Oregon than anybody, Dave Leland, to come up here and join me, and we're going to go to school.
Thank you. And we've only got 5 minutes because we have the Water Resources Department who's going to give us a schooling on water rights. But I appreciate it, and thank you for being here, Mr. Leland. I saw you back there, and he's taught me just about everything I know about sanitary surveys as well. So, and for the record.
For the record, I'm Dave Leland. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm manager of the State Drinking Water Program.
So,
And I'm looking at this for the first time, so
well, okay.
I will admit right away.
The fiscal part.
Yeah. This is the first time that they've seen this fiscal analysis representative.
Was it last time?
Oh, I have the answer.
Okay.
It didn't take long. Madam Chair, this is the chart here is actually just including the community water systems, of which there are about 882. So it's an example of how it breaks down for community water systems. So if you look at a 3 to 5 year schedule, that would come out to about 200 a year.
And can you define community water systems for folks who don't know what those parameters are?
Yes, Madam Chair. Community water systems serve year-round residents. At least 15 connections, at least 25 people and up. So the community water systems in Oregon, roughly just short of 900 community-type water systems in Oregon.
And then as a follow-up to that, how many below 15, because that could be a subdivision, could be smaller, how many below 15 do we have?
Madam Chair, just to clarify that a little more, that is one type of public water system in that size range. The other type is non-community water systems that serve people, 25 or more people that are not residents. So could be those campgrounds we go to that we love going to. Could be a school with its own individual water supply. And there are actually over 1,400 of those water systems. And then as a third piece, there are the very small systems that don't serve 25 people. And those are subject to state law, not federal law. But we have state standards that they're to meet under our own state law. And there are almost 1,000 of those that we know of.
And as far as how this table was configured, this mm-hmm. since you're talking about here doing surveys once every 5 years under law, so we're talking about biennial revenue. So can you maybe that's where the what assumptions go into the $216,000 number that we see here? And I realize that this is just proposed, but that would be helpful, or if somebody from LFO can also explain that.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, I'm afraid on the explanation of the exact table, this was the what was provided our office as to as far as how they would get to their overall other funds revenue piece. And I'm afraid I can't provide any additional.
So let me ask this differently. You're saying you're looking at two FTE for, to administer this program. So I can only guess that you said with two FTE, this is about the number of community water systems that we can survey in a biennium. So, and that's how you came up with those numbers. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Madam Chair, if I may, as I look at this further while I'm reading furiously while everyone is speaking here, it looks like this table is the fee revenue and doesn't include the federal revenue that we get as match.
Okay.
I think that's so, you know, there's another piece of this, which is the federal dollars. And I think that's how this table is constructed. That's that what I'm, so there's another piece here, which then together those two pieces would fund the positions for the 18 months and then 24 months.
Okay,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
The point I'm not clear on, it's quite clear from the other side that this $216,000 will trigger $114,000 in the first biennium of federal funds match, giving you a total of $330,000, which is enough to staff the program. But are you going to propose a separate set of fees for the non-community and the smaller drinking the water supplies, and if so, why is that not part of this overall LFO analysis?
Representative Cannon, the answer to that is yes, and I don't know why it's not on here. So
it looks like there needs to be a little bit of coordination there. And I think Representative Burley also has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Cannon hit on Part A, and that was under the revenues on page one. You show the 216, but what is omitted is the non-community portion. But if you go to the top part of that ledger, the expenditures, then one would have to presume those expenses are also considered to be from the communities. Community systems and would not include the non-community, so I'm presuming then that the expenses would probably go up too if we're including both community and non-community. The other question I have, though, if you look at the personal services other funds line, how do we go from $75,000 this biennium to two times that in the 2009-11?
Chair and Representative Burley, on the position costs, the whole measure, it has an effective date of January 1, 2008, so it's 18 months of costs for the 07-09 biennium and then a full 24 months of costs of 09-11.
Thank you.
And I would, if I may, point out for the record that what the department submitted was part of an overall policy package that is included in the governor's budget. However, that policy package has multiple concepts in it related to water, and so this is what the department provided for this particular piece of enabling legislation associated with that package.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
You get to talking about a whole bunch of different water users or water suppliers out here, and then we're also talking about the federal mandate that you have. I have a couple questions on the federal mandate, but let the first one be: what of the users that you're involved with does this federal mandate and RE, the matching money, apply to? Does this apply to all of the, whether they're community users or individual users, or is this all of the above or none of the above?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, the EPA funds we can use on the water systems subject to EPA regulations.
What
so this
are
would
those?
Be all the water systems that serve 25 or more people. whether they're communities or non-communities.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're looking at, and you will be then, correct me if you will be doing water surveys, if this legislation is to pass, on the non-community water systems that include 25 or more.
That's correct.
And correct me or help me with the arithmetic here now. Will those fees that we see in front of us for community be the same for non-community? Or will they be for free?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, the specific dollar amount will be determined as a result of this rulemaking process. It is the design and the intent from
Ms.
the
Schipper, you will understand first off, Madam Chair, that I get uneasy with rulemaking processes.
I understand.
And I would be much more comfortable with statutory language with this. And I would be proposing that we reduce this to statutory language rather than relying on rulemaking and allow some latitude within the statute probably for adjustments downward if you don't need all the money. But I think we're getting confused with all of the different groups that we're talking about, and the illustration that we're having is for one specific part, and that is the community water supply, which would normally lead me to believe that the others were no way to be figured into this equation.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I appreciate that. There are several pieces in there. One is, I know that folks are working hard, they're smart, they're experienced, they're diligent. I can't speak to this. I don't know that this is particularly accurate. And as you know, DHS is an enormous agency and trying, I think, to tease out specific fiscal impacts for very interrelated policy option packages has got to be challenging at best. So I can't speak to the quality of the numbers going in, and I certainly can't speak to the quality of the numbers going out. And I apologize that this clearly is confusing folks. I wish you didn't have it, frankly, because it seems like, it's obfuscating rather than illuminating, and I'm sorry for that, very much so.
Can you address the question that he raised about the community versus non-community fee, though? I think that would be helpful.
Yes, all of the discussion from the task force, all of the agreement, consensus, everything is that all water systems of any type that are subject to federal 25 or more connections will be considered for this fee. Now, the discussions that we've had recognize that the large water systems can afford to pay full freight, and they will. And as you heard Mr. Tiffany say, we don't like it, but we understand it, we will. And the smaller systems, we also recognize, just have a smaller base with which to disperse any increase in costs, and they are paying, I think, something like 20 cents on the dollar or something like that, based on whatever the proposed fee is finalized as. We have identified what the actual cost of a single inspection is plus follow-up, and we've identified proposed fee per inspection. And as I said, we are now able to help out those 300 and below because of the federal dollars that will be matched, and also because of additional general fund dollars that are included in the governor's recommended budget.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Bob to Representative Jensen to finish up, take one more question, and then we're going to have to move on to the Water Resources Department bill, but I do have a follow-up question for you.
Well, I've got a couple of things here, Madam Chair, but first off, as far as these stay with the numbers now in the community water supply connections, what we've got, quote-unquote, a federal mandate here. What is the liability of the department if we tell this particular mandate to go bye-bye and don't fund it?
Okay. Let you move the
sure. I don't want to squish this. Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, we can certainly do that. And, in fact, I believe in the history of the state we have done that.
It
didn't last very long before we wanted it back for a few reasons. One, the water suppliers, the thousands of them around the state, don't particularly like dealing with a post office box in Seattle, so to speak, in terms of any oversight and assistance. Two, we also lose not only, of course, the millions of dollars coming in from the feds for this primacy oversight, but also the approximately $11 million now a year in state revolving fund that has lent $130 million out to local communities all over the state in submarket loans. And so the impact is from a very real practical operational standpoint, and it's from a very real practical financial standpoint. It's not good news.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I know you want to move, and I'm
okay.
Trying to be, and I do appreciate this. And what I would like to see, Madam Chair, before you bring this back to committee, is I'd like to see a breakdown of all of the water suppliers and the same sort of thing that you have for the community water suppliers, mm-hmm. the same list of things, and then the a spreadsheet similar to what you have here as to whether or not they're going to be figured into the financial aspect of that. And Madam Chair, I think when we have that, I think this thing becomes fairly clear and fairly obvious where we want to go with it. And I appreciate the members of the committee, struggling with this. And I apologize for not opening my mouth earlier and maybe saving us some time, I think, with it. Madam Chair, if there's anything you'd like to have me do with the department while they're working their way through this before it comes back, I'd be happy to offer to try to do that.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. I think you read my mind because that was exactly what I was going to ask this panel if they could do. If you could work with the department to make sure that the information that you requested, and also in that sheet, please make sure and define what is community versus non-community, what's subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act versus state water law or surveys. That would be helpful. And I know that you reviewed some of this a few weeks ago, but I'm sure folks don't have that information right at the top of their head. So I think that would be helpful. And then also maybe explain how when you're doing these surveys over a five-year period, how that would also be helpful to see more than one biennia on the table here of how that's going to work. I mean, I know it's going to be the same fee over time, but maybe looking out over several biennia how that's going to be collected. So, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. At first, I was a little uneasy on the open fee, but I guess I had to remind myself that Gail has an excellent track record of operating her part of DHS, and in 2 years she's going to need to come back to this body for ratification of the fee, and so it gives her a little bit of time to work through, figure out what the fee is going to be, and then come back to us with the justification. And so while that hit my eye instantly, I think this makes a lot of sense and deserves a little bit of latitude.
Great. Thank you for that comment. And thank you all. Any other parting or last-minute questions?
Well,
they will come back.
I'll make one comment which might give some guidance, and that is that one thing that catches my eye is to see a substantial number of inspections in that lower tier who are being charged nothing. And any sort of fair cost allocation, it seems like there ought to be some proportionality to the amount of work associated with each tier. So just keep that in mind, that something, having a one whole large class of user that's being charged nothing, sort of sticks out in relation to the others.
I like that.
Okay, thank you.
We've been there.
Yes, we've been there last session, but we appreciate the
thank
comment.
You, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2187. And I'm going to open up the public hearing. Actually, we're going to have an informational hearing. Well, I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 2101, and we're going to start with colleagues. I know you are thinking that you are going to get away without a Water Rights 101 primer, but before we jump into the Water Resources Department fee bill, I've asked them if they will come forward and give us a brief overview of Water Rights 101. Now, colleagues, I think you should have all gotten copies of this book in your box, which I will say Representative Cannon went home immediately and read it and came back and told me it was fabulous nighttime reading.
It was indeed. My commendation to the department for this excellent book with beautiful photos and very clear and historical and interesting text.
So feel free to quiz him on any of the terms you will hear here today. And
Madam Chair, I've gotten to page 5 and already have two comments about this.
But
you don't include the range on here. You got township but not range. And you say that under Oregon law, all water is publicly owned. If I'm not mistaken, that is state-owned versus federal. Isn't that correct? Federal government does not have any water rights. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the record, Phil Ward,
that's correct.
I'm sorry, let me revise that. There is such a thing as a federally reserved water right, but that is granted through our process.
By the state.
Right.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I think there's a lot of things that pass through the Congress of the United States and through the courts that would indicate to me that there's that other body that doesn't seem to realize or understand Representative Burley's comments about the state ownership of the waters of the state.
We won't go there right now, Representative Jensen.
That's Water 101, right. Madam Chair.
Actually, I was going to ask you if you could share with the rest of the committee members what the motto of our Water Committee was the last three sessions.
The motto of our Water Committee 2 years ago was whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting.
You will often find that is the case, and I have to say I still have that good bottle of whiskey sitting on my shelf, and many people come in and are very covetous of that, but that was
your
motto.
Your moderation is overwhelming.
I may need to open that up sooner than I thought, though. So, beware. You know, and we did
make sure that Representative Burley isn't there when you open it up.
Represent that remark.
It's well-aged Pendleton whiskey, but we did steal that from Mark Twain. Is that correct? We did not make up that motto. Just
no,
want to make sure we stole that from Mark Twain. But
as old as Methuselah.
Yeah. So thank you. Well, I appreciate you being here. And there's a lot of, water jokes you will hear thrown around here that only several of us will find funny. But for some members, this is going to be review. But as I said, for a person who's been working on this for 20 years, I learn something new every day. And since we're coming up to the almost centennial of our water code, I thought it'd be good to review the basics because we will be making many decisions based on the information you will hear here today. So with that, thanks for being here. And we're going to do this, and then we'll jump into your bill.
So, Madam Chair, again, for the record, Phil Ward, Director of the Water Resources Department. I'll start things off here and then turn them over to Ms. Colbert in just a second. But I was hoping to ask Representative Jensen, in light of his earlier comments, whether he knew what the names of the first two water masters in Oregon were.
I do, but I want somebody else to guess.
Smith and Wesson, members.
That's good.
Okay, so the old adage is water law is not rocket science, it's worse. And I know that our assertions that this is an easy business have been exposed. It's not very complicated, but as Representative Burley mentioned earlier, that the public, the state of Oregon, is the steward and holder of all the water in our state, that is surface and groundwater. The state functions under a little legal theory called the doctrine of prior appropriation, which essentially means that if you're first in time in terms of having your use of the water established as the most senior, then you're first in right. You get to use it and get your full rate and duty of that use as allowed in your water right before anyone who is junior to you. Our water code was established in the state in 1909, and we have a water rights system for how we give out water rights in the state that includes the three things you see mentioned there. We're going to touch on each of these areas if I can make it work. Okay, we'll try that one. Okay, we're not... there we go. We got something there.
And, Phil, we are going to have to, because we spent so much time on the last bill, we're going to give you till... Do you think you can whip through this in 10 minutes, and then we'll move on to your... Because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for public
testimony. We'll do the abbreviated version. So, again, just the principle of public water. That's the way we manage things here. I want to mention... Just real quickly, that we do have to conduct adjudications for rights that are asserted to have been in place before the groundwater code was established. So the most famous of these is currently nearing completion, and that's the Klamath adjudication, which we actually began in 1975. It was delayed by two federal court cases that worked all the way through the system and finally established Oregon's right to manage its own water resource and adjudicate it for all the interests in the Klamath Basin. So we're very close to finishing that up.
I'm giving him the evil eye. He said a quick question.
Very quickly, what's significant about 1909? I missed that point.
1909 is when this body enacted Oregon's first water code.
Okay, thank you.
So this is the 1909 water code. It said to use water, you got to use it beneficially without waste. It said that if you're the oldest right, you get to use it first. Here's an important point. It says it's attached to the land. It's appurtenant to the land on which it is used. So you can't just wander it all around without addressing that. And you've got to use it once every 5 years or you lose it. And you've got to use it beneficially when you use it once every 5 years. Okay, so here's these basic pieces. This is just an example of the kind of things that are beneficial use. I would point out at the bottom of the list, in-stream flows are considered a beneficial use of water statutorily in this state. Here's a bit on the priority doctrine. So if I'm a senior user and I'm at the bottom of the creek and I've got a 1910 right, and Dr. Colbert here is up above me, she's got a 1970 right, she has to make sure that I get my full rate and duty before she can take hers. I personally like the arrangement if I'm that senior guy. Appurtenancy, if the land's sold, the water doesn't go with the sale of that land. It stays with the parcel to which it is attached unless at some time that water is formally transferred. We'll talk about that just a little briefly. Unless that water is formally transferred. But the basic principle is the water stays with the land. Okay, you got to use it, and you have to use it beneficially at least once in every 5 years. Okay, this is for you, Debbie, and I'll go ahead and run the machine.
Well, in general, today there's we kind of think of the permitting system as a three-step process. Someone comes into the Water Resources Department, they make application for a new right to use or authorization to use water, either groundwater or surface water of the state. Once we deem that that application is complete, that becomes the priority date for that right. We have standards that we have set forth both in statute and rule for reviewing that request for new use of water. Things like, is water available to support the use? Is it specifically withdrawn, that water body, by statute? So we have a whole array of standards that we use to review each of these groundwater and surface water and other authorizations. Assuming we find that it's consistent with all of those standards, we would issue a water right permit. And then the water user has a certain amount of time, typically 4 to 5 years, to make beneficial use of that water, put the water to use under the terms and conditions of the permit, and at the end of that process, they'll submit proof to us that they've made that use, and we would review the proof that they submit, and if it's consistent with what we had issued, then we would issue a water right certificate. Once it becomes a water right certificate, it becomes a right that's subject to transfer or changes to that use. So, for example, if you have a water right to irrigate 100 acres at a specified location and you have a water right certificate, you can come back into the department and propose to move that 100 acres from the existing place of use to some new use. And that is the only mechanism by which that water right can be severed from that particular piece of land and put onto a different piece of land, is through that water right transfer process, which is made through application to our department. You can do things like you can add additional points of diversion, or new wells to your right where you want to take the water out. You can change the location. You can change the type of use. It might be that you have an existing irrigation right, but you've changed your practices and you want to go toward nursery use. So you can make application through transfer to go from irrigation to nursery use. So a basic water right consists of four key elements. It identifies the source of water to be used. It identifies the type of use that's going to occur. The point at which the water is going to be taken out or pumped from the ground, and the place of use where it will be applied. And, Madam Chair, you were specifically interested in having us provide an example water right certificate for the committee, and we're passing those around now for you to look at, and then we also have that same certificate, the images provided in this. And so if you can click through, we'll... So just to kind of... I'll take a minute while you're handing those out. Just to tick through these, again, these basic elements of a water right certificate, you can see that this is a certificate to use water from the Alsea River. So that's the source of the water. It's for irrigation. That's the type of use of up to 24.4 acres. The priority date for the right is April 8, 1969. The quantity of water that can be used for irrigation under this right is a maximum of 0.36 cubic feet per second, which is about 160 gallons per minute, and up to 2.5 acre feet per acre. And then also it provides a description of where the specific point at which that water will be taken out of the stream.
And we do have both township and range on the certificate.
Yes. And then you'll just note that on the back of the certificate, we've provided a kind of final proof survey for this right. And so you can see the actual map. But at the bottom of the certificate, as kind of shown here, there's a very specific description of where that use can occur. And that's accompanied with this type of map that becomes kind of the footprint for that irrigation right. I was going to say, this is really for those folks who live within a water district that will never, see one of these for the city slickers. This is a good example for them to see what.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question about
this? Representative Cannon.
Thank you. Is the 0.36 cubic feet per second of the allowable diversion, does that equate to the 2.5 acre feet, or is there a sort of seasonal, is this assuming that it's running year-round, or how?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. It's basically both an instantaneous quantity that they can be pulling out of the Alsea River, and then over the course of their irrigation season, it's the volume of water they could take. So it's a two-part for in the example of an irrigation right. Now, other rights, like industrial use, they don't have a volume limitation identified in their right typically. It's just an instantaneous rate that they can't exceed.
So there may be a separate determination. Here's the instantaneous, the feet per second that you're allowed, but there's also a separate determination about what's reasonable over the course of the year. Yeah.
Continue. We just
just kind of to round out the 101, we just wanted to mention that since 1987, with the adoption of the In-Stream Water Right Act, there are a number of other types of beneficial uses have been recognized by the state, and also the ability for certain state agencies, like the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Parks and Recs, have the authority to make application to the Water Resources Department for the issuance of in-stream water rights to support uses like recreation, water quality, and fish and wildlife. And we can issue rights based on those requests. We also have a number of tools. We've kind of shown you an example of an out-of-stream certificate type use. We have a number of tools, and we touched on these very briefly with the committee on Friday when we were talking about some of our bills before the committee. We have a number of tools by statute where people can take their existing out-of-stream rights and request to have those turned into in-stream water rights. When they are converted to in-stream water rights, they take their priority date with them, and we protect it, again, by priority date. In-stream, and you can do it through in-stream leasings, which are short-term in-stream rights, in-stream transfers, which can be for up to 25 years, or permanent in-stream, and then also through allocations of conserved water, which is mechanisms where you might have existing right, you change your practices, and you're able to save water and take a portion of that and put it in-stream, and a portion you could spread onto new lands.
And Debbie, just to clarify, in-stream water right has only been a beneficial use since 1987. That was a new beneficial use that was added, and ODF&W is the one who oversees those in-stream. Is that right?
Madam Chair, once they become in-stream water rights, they're actually held for the public in the name of the Water Resources Department.
ODF&W, though, reviews, they have a role.
ODF&W can request, Madam Chair, in-stream water right, as can Parks and Recreation and Department of Environmental Quality.
Thank you.
Sure. The allocation of conserved water, if a user lines or pipes an irrigation canal, for example, and half that water is allowed to then, you know, remain in the stream, do you issue a separate in-stream water right for that portion that's the allocation of conserved water, or does it all just stay in the same original?
Madam Chair, Representative, once we've calculated how much has been saved, by statute, the state gets 25% of that minimum. That becomes a separate in-stream water right certificate. The other 75%
with the priority date of the original.
With the priority date of the original right.
Hmm.
The other 75% is available to the water user to spread onto new lands or to basically market and put in stream or move to other locations. Now, that ratio can change depending on how much public funds paid for the project. So if 50% of the project, the lining project in your example, was paid by public funds, then at a minimum 50% of that saved water becomes an in-stream water right. And that's a ratio allocation that was set forth in statute when this new tool was developed.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
So, Madam Chair, to finish this up, the way we operate this system is obviously if there are senior rights, be they in-stream or out-of-stream, there has to be somebody out there making sure the folks that have those senior rights are getting their water. And that's what this gentleman is. He is a real-life water master, kind of a medieval title. But we've got a core of them around the state, and they make sure. Yeah, this is this guy's kind of a combination of the two. But they are a neat and very unique group of people that have functioned effectively many years. It's a mature, what I call a mature regulatory system around the state, and most water users know when they see the water master coming that it's their time and they're going to have to shut her down. Just quickly, this is a map that is unclear from here, but it just shows all the surface water diversions in Oregon. These are all the places where people actually take water out of a surface water body in our state. Mm-hmm. And this map shows all the wells in our state. So we will we'll quit it there in the interest of time.
I was going to say, I hope that cow is not in the water.
We have cows on the riverbank there. That might have been a good slide to skip.
Well, thank you. That is probably one of the best Water Rights 101, or as I said, Water Rights for Dummies, as we can say. This was not... Not that our committee.
Who are you calling here?
This is for us, no. And I would encourage you, this is really an excellent guide, and I, as we will be referring to many of the concepts in here, encourage you to read this and memorize it, and we will have a quiz probably at the next committee. So I'm going to ask you to testify. I am going to let the committee members know that at 2:50, we're going to take a recess, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2565. Since the director of the Department of Energy cannot be here on Friday, I'd like to open that work session. So just want to make sure, and then if we have any other testimony, we will continue that or continue on Friday. But thank you for that primer. I'm sure we'll have other issues. I'll certainly want to have you come back as we... But that is really the basics of Oregon water law, and we'd be happy to share the volumes and volumes of information that's out there on it anytime needed. So, then with that, that closes the informational hearing portion, and now we are going to actually open up the testimony portion of House Bill 2101.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, Phil Ward, Director of the Water Resources Department. This is an important piece of legislation for the agency. I wanted to be here personally and have the opportunity to talk it through with you, make sure at some point we get all your questions answered. But this bill, House Bill 2101, is, as Dr. Colbert here has coined, a fee adjustment bill. For the agency. We're trying not to use the term fee increase, though I did slip and put it in my testimony a couple places. This is a fee adjustment bill that does include some increases for the agency. It increases fees in several categories of our water rights program. Fees associated with regular water right applications and transfer applications. Debbie just talked a little bit about transfers and a number of other associated fees. The other thing that this does that I think is important is that it adjusts fees so the cost of actually us reviewing and doing our work related to an application more closely reflects the work required by that application. So if you have a more complicated application, then under this scheme, you'll pay more money to the agency. Again, quickly, just some quick background. Processing water right applications and transfers has gotten extremely complex in this era of less water available. We get about 450 new water right applications every year. Plus, again, these fees apply to transfers as well. We get about 300 applications to transfer water every year. That number is going up every year, because as less water becomes available for new water rights, the way people are meeting their needs is they're finding a water right on Debbie's place and they're purchasing that from her and then asking us to transfer it to their property so it can be used there. So what this bill would do is it would give us the resources to keep up with our current level of processing and to continue to eliminate the backlog we have in the transfer program, which is fairly significant. Without the fee adjustment, there are about four staff tied to this fee proposal, two in the water right application program, two in the transfer program. So it would reduce our staff. They'd go away without a fee adjustment here. And I think it's important to note that even with this fee adjustment, we only recover from the applicants about one-third of the cost of processing these applications and transfers. Some years ago, we proposed a larger fee increase. The last time we came to the legislature on this issue, that was reduced, and we were asked to begin coming incrementally rather than waiting a long time. So that's why we're here just 4 years after our last fee increase.
Adjustment, right.
Thank you, sir.
See how quick my committee members are?
Our last fee adjustment. We started discussions with our stakeholders over a year ago on this issue and our commission, and that's where we got the guidance, frankly, though I think you'll hear some objection to what we came up with ultimately, but that's where we got the guidance to make the fee reflect the amount of work required in an application. So, again, passage of this bill will keep us at our current staffing levels and our current ratio of fees to general fund in these programs, and it's essential to us being able to continue to deliver the service to our customer base. So, Madam Chair, with that, I think we'd be happy to stop and entertain questions. There are several attachments there. We can speak to those.
Yeah, if you could, why don't you go ahead and do that, because okay. That's one of the things I was going to ask you to
do. So, Madam Chair, attachment one shows you right out there in black and white the different types of fees that are reflected here and then the proposed adjustments. So if you look at the first one, well, that's kind of a unique one. That's an opportunity that we're only going to refund less than we would if an application is withdrawn. So let's look at something that's let's go to the second one there. Surface and groundwater application. The base fee is currently $300. This would move it to $5. And then where the next line below that, so the third line in the table, each additional point of diversion. So what that means is if you put in an application to drill a new well and there's one well proposed in that application, then you pay $300. That's your application fee. However, today we are finding people sometimes apply for multiple wells on one application. And there's a logic to that because it doesn't cost you any more to apply for more, and if you include multiple well sites, then you perhaps have a chance, a greater chance, of getting the water you need. What that's done, though, is it's increased the workload on the agency. So what this bill would do for the first time is for each additional point of diversion, it would add $200, and that's new, that hasn't happened before.
Okay. A couple quick questions on that. And colleagues, we will actually end up, this public hearing will be carried over till Friday because I think we have lots of people signed up. All of them are within this building, nobody is from out of the building. So I just want to make sure everybody's okay with coming back on Friday. If anybody isn't, then I'll make sure you come up and testify first, but because we have several people want to come up and testify. I have a couple of quick questions, and then we'll take questions from the committee and go on to the other witnesses. As far as what percentage of your costs are covered right now through your fees, and then with the fee, with the proposed fee increases, what does that change to?
Madam Chair, generally, and this relates specifically for this program to the table that's in your handout. That's attachment three. Yeah, the chart, excuse me. This chart really represents the way our application programs are funded today across the board. So in a general sense, the general fund has covered historically about 70% and fees about 30%. And that's fairly consistent across all the programs in the application type programs in the agency. So 70-30, and this will not change that ratio. This would, if this fee is not, mm-hmm. these fees are not adopted, that ratio does, you know, would change. But this would make that ratio remain the same.
So if I'm reading this right, if we do not have this fee increase, then it drops down to 20%, given cost increases.
You know, if indeed that 9% were made up somewhere else. If that 9% were not made up somewhere, we'd be reducing 4 staff people.
The other question I had is in regards to the groundwater. Just for clarification, that's only for groundwater wells that don't fall under the exempt category. Is that correct? The surface and groundwater application, basically?
Madam Chair, that is correct. These are just for the groundwater rights that require application to the department, not the exempt uses of groundwater.
Other questions? Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
No, Mayor.
Okay.
If it looks to me like this would be about a 30% roughly increase in fees, what on the general fund side, I know that's not what's in front of us today, but I'd be interested in knowing what, how does that compare? How does your request for 07-09 compare with what you had 05-07?
Madam Chair, Representative, in the fee partner programs, in the programs where fees partner with general fund, the general fund then moves forward at what we call the estimated budget level. Basically, it's maintained the same level with a little money for inflation. So essentially, it's the same level of general fund versus fee revenue.
The ratio remains the same as would be.
I understand the ratio remains the same, but in real dollars, we're looking at 30% increase on the fee side. Is it roughly a 30% increase on the general fund side? I know to a lot of people that would be like, oh wow, but I understand that costs increase. So you can feel comfortable giving that answer if that's the case.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe it is, and so I think that the fee increase reflects the need to establish a level of fees that will provide out into the future over a four-year horizon, so not just 2 years, but over a four-year horizon, funds to support the program. So I don't believe the general fund increase is anywhere near that magnitude.
Okay. Thanks.
And colleagues, just a reminder, this bill will also be coming to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, and we'll be having all those discussions as well. Representative Farley?
Just very quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. There's in the proposed amendments, there's no automatic annual adjustments. This is just, if I understood what you said, this is what you project you'll need for the next 4 years.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly true.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Smith, you look like you're scratching your head.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. If we take the first fee, we talked about the surface and groundwater application base fee, from the current fee of $300 to the proposed of $500, that's a 60% increase. And so then if I divide that by four years, that still represents about a 16-17% increase per biennium. I divide that by two, and that's still an 8% increase. Our cost of inflation is going to run us 2-3%. What are we using that extra 5-6% for per year?
Madam Chair, Representative, that simply represents the true cost of operating the program. But in the aggregate, all these fees represent what we calculate is the true cost of operating the program over that four-year period. Specific pieces of this are more or less because there are certain areas that generate more money or that we haven't chosen to come forward as far on in terms of asking increases. So it may well be that this piece is greater than some of the other pieces in the portfolio. Is that fair to say, Debbie?
Madam Chair, I think that's a fair way to say it. And basically, we had to we look back at a historical record of how many applications of the different types and sizes and wells. We use that historical data to project what we could expect in the future and then and what it would take to support those programs going over 4 years and based our fee adjustment on that projection.
Just a quick follow-up.
And
Phil, I was with you on this until I started just breaking this down to the simplest component. And I guess I need this, but I'd like to see how an 8% increase per year. Maybe you can give me a worksheet like this on how 8% is going to be, an 8% increase would be utilized in hard numbers.
And
to me, I don't know a lot of businesses that get an 8% increase every year. So that's my thought.
Thank you. What also I thought would be helpful if you can give us a chart that shows the what the fees were mean, historically, over time, that we have not had consistent increases. It hasn't been 8% every biennium. I think it's helpful. I mean, some of us have been looking at this for several biennia, but for folks that haven't, I think it would be helpful to show a little bit of the history of the fee structure.
Well, another, if I could just quickly, I've stayed on top of this issue down in Ways and Means, and so I'm glad to hear the Ways and Means process will have a chance to look at this. Excuse me, I'm talking about you. Have a chance to look at this because I think you have a lot of knowledgeable folks down in that Ways and Means process who are going to scratch their heads on this.
Thank you. Did you have a comment? Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. If I just could respond real quickly. Part of the issue here is that these things go in fits and starts. So there's not a consistent percent per year increase as Representative Burley identified. So historically what we do is we have an increase that's much larger than the cost of inflation, and it's designed then to carry you much more than that year. And so essentially it's designed to create a balance of funds at the beginning end when they first start coming in, and then you live off that fund balance over time.
Quick follow-up then.
Follow-up.
Could we just index this to a rate of inflation then, so that way we tie it to the actual cost of providing the service?
Madam Chair, that would certainly
it'd work better for you,
be possible. I mean, you all could do that. In legislatures past, they have not chosen to do that with our fees. They've chosen the solid cap. If I could make one closing comment,
sure.
Madam Chair. Some of you are aware, many of you may not be, that this agency at one time had extremely significant backlogs in its application programs. Literally thousands of water right applications backlogged. It was a matter of significant controversy in this building at one point in time. There were statutory changes made to streamline the process, and then that's when this fee structure, kind of in the current ratio that it's set up as today, was established. I think it's just important to note that to maintain our current ability to deal with these programs in a manner that doesn't create significant backlogs, this is a big piece of that equation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you being here and providing this excellent overview. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2101. And I'm hoping that the folks who signed up, are you all able to come back on Friday? I'm seeing nodding heads around. Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the hearing on 2101. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2565. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Graney. If you could come up to the podium. And I certainly would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
I move that I speak very slowly. I move House Bill 25.
It's 2101.
Sorry. No, we're not doing 2101.
You're right. I've got too many in front of me.
65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And gosh, I hope I got that right.
You did. Thank you. Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2565 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And I just, for the record, want to mention that Representative Jensen was the co-sponsor of the original bill with me last session, so I want to thank him for that.
Well, that tells me a lot.
Okay, so those of the opinion that House Bill 2565 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Fire?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Aye. I'd also look for a motion for consent calendar if folks are amenable to that.
I move that we put House Bill 2565 on the consent calendar, Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon moves that House Bill 2565 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, with that, the motion, I should have said that before. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed, and that then the motion for the consent calendar, is that correct? Also is passed. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2565, and I will...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for accommodating my schedule. Biofuels bill on the consent calendar.
Yeah, and I'm going to close the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.